because if you were going to learn how to draw the human figure, you would draw nudes. And women were not allowed to go in there because of, oh, their weak constitution, they might faint, and this is so inappropriate. But it's not for men. And right. So a lot of women were excluded from the academies. They couldn't learn along with other students. A lot of them who did learn to paint learned from their fathers who were artists.
Welcome to Historical Fiction Unpacked. I'm your host, Allison Treat. Hello, readers, and welcome back to the show. This is episode 12 of season 7, and today I'm sharing a conversation I had with Erin Bartles. Erin is an award-winning author who writes character-driven fiction for curious people. Her latest novel is about art and artists, and I think you're going to love this conversation. It was really a great one, so much packed into this time with Erin. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Erin Bartles. Erin, thank you for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you. Your latest novel, The Lady with the Dark Hair, just released on Tuesday. Can you tell me about this book?
Yeah, it's a dual timeline story where the modern timeline is a woman and her mother who own a very small, sort of obscure museum dedicated to an ancestor's work, a painter. And the past timeline kind of tells the story of that person, but also of another person who might be the subject of some of that person's paintings. So it follows two different women. The past is in starts in 1878. So it's in southern France and Gibraltar and a little bit in northern Africa. It's kind of globetrotting in the past and a little bit more domestic in the present, but there'll be a little bit of travel there too.
Yeah, that's great. I started reading it and I love it so far. So can you tell me what inspired you to write this novel?
Yeah, I think so. That's always a little bit of a difficult question. I don't know why, because a lot of different things come together to eventually become an idea for a novel for me. It's never usually one big flash. But I have been an artist as long as, you know, I've been able to be an artist, or I've been artistic. I was an artistic child. I was always interested in art classes, and I've done a lot of painting in the past, I'd say 5 or 6 years, a lot of oil painting, which I hadn't done in the past. And I had a lot of fun doing it, and combining that with reconnecting with a former professor who's from Gibraltar. And I thought, well, that'd be an interesting place to set a story because I've never read anything set in Gibraltar. Yeah. And I don't think most people know much about it.
No.
Except that it's, you know, the logo for Prudential or whatever is the Rock of Gibraltar.
Okay. Yeah.
I think that's how most Americans know it. But it's strange because it used to be a very well-known place. And when you went on your European tour, you were going to stop there. That was probably one of the first stops a lot of people made. In fact, a lot of interesting people have been there. Wordsworth, Lord Byron, Mark Twain, you know, lots of people have stories about traveling through there. And it's just an interesting place because it's got such a fascinating history of changing hands and warfare and ships and all sorts of fun stuff. So I guess those two ideas must have come together at some point, the art and the place.
Okay, cool. I was really surprised or maybe even shocked by the quotes that you have in the front of the book. So can you tell me a little bit about those quotes and why you put
Absolutely. Well, you don't really have to look hard to find quotes, especially in the past, that are not terribly flattering about how people viewed women and women's abilities.
Right.
And so I open the book with a series of quotes that kind of get worse and worse as you read them about whether women are capable of great work or whether they're capable of anything as good as a man.
Right.
And then you turn the page and the dedication is for the women. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, I think that we know intellectually today, men and women's brains are basically the same. We have different hormonal balances. We have different innate sort of abilities in a lot of ways, but not always. But I have always been someone who felt a lot of competition with men, but not with women. I always wanted to be as good as or better than the guys who were around me in school or whatever. A lot. I don't know exactly where that came from, but I never really felt that with women. I always felt collaborative with women, but kind of combative with some men. And it's because of attitudes like that, because right. even when I was growing up in the 90s, there was still a lot of people who just said kind of crappy things to you that were related to your gender. And so I always felt angry about that. But this is not an angry book, and it's not a man pushing book at all. These characters have really great relationships with some men in their lives, and these are people who kind of push them to think of their lives as being bigger than they're allowing them to be. So what I like is that there's a balance in this story, because, you know, some men are great and some men, you know, really aren't. But the great ones are really great.
Right. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. I love that it's not like male bashing, but it's saying like, why, just challenging those ridiculous notions that women weren't capable of. If it, especially like the great art, I was kind of like, what?
Well, I think that, you know, we think of women as maybe today people think more of women doing artistic things. Maybe women seem more creative than men.
Right.
But in the past, the art that they were allowed to do was, if you were a woman of some means, you were probably going to learn how to draw or do watercolors of botanicals, just like you'd learn French and you'd learn the piano. And you would maybe do decorative arts. A lot of people have looked down on women's arts throughout the ages that are more of an artisan type thing, like quilting, making rugs, making clothes for their families, all sorts of things, home goods, things like that. And those were seen as, that's appropriate for women. They can decorate things. But right. the idea that they could paint something important was definitely not in people's minds for a long time. And what's interesting is how many women painters we've never heard of today. While I was researching this book, I read a great book called The Mirror and the Palette by Jennifer Higge. And I highly recommend it to anyone who's interested in the history of women painters. And it's 500 years of female painters, and most of them I hadn't heard of. And I already knew quite a bit about art, and most of them you won't find in museums, but a lot of their work was lost because they didn't sign their work, because it was considered, you know, something that they weren't supposed to be doing or they weren't capable of doing. A lot of their work's been misattributed to men, sometimes their teachers. Wow. And so, yeah, there's always been women doing great work. And it's really fun to know that in our day, they're rediscovering a lot of that.
So how are they discovering that again? I mean, how do you find out who painted it?
Well, some of it has to do with realizing that something you thought was by one person may not be. And a lot of that has to do with looking a little closer at the technique that was used, the timing, whatever provenance you can find for where the painting came from and who owned it, when. And some of it has to do with just, you know, finding things in, honestly, estate sales and flea markets and things that people don't really know what they've got, and realizing like, oh, this is something good, and this is something important, and I want to look into this more. And I know that a lot of work's being done by museum curators, because people really want to get more of these works into their museum collections, which is great, because when lots of people want something, it drives up the price, and then that drives up the implied importance of a piece.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So interesting. So you mentioned a little bit about this, but did you want to say any more about the limits in history and the expectations of women? I mean, we talked about how they're decorative. They can take part in decorative art. I'm making an assumption, like women are decorative and they're allowed to decorate things.
Yes, exactly. Well, what's interesting is, I mean, whenever you're thinking about women's history, there's always a lot of hypocrisy and irony. So you've got centuries of men painting naked women, but women were not allowed to go into a life drawing class because they might see a naked man. And that was not appropriate. Because if you were going to learn how to draw the human figure, you would draw nudes. And women were not allowed to go in there because of, oh, their weak constitution, they might faint, and this is so inappropriate. But it's not for men. And right. So a lot of women were excluded from the academies. They couldn't learn along with other students. A lot of them who did learn to paint learned from their fathers who were artists or from private tutors. So then you've got this case where you have to make sure, like, it would only be available to people with some money and some standing. So there's that limit as well. And that's true of any art that doesn't make you a good living immediately or ever.
Right.
It's certainly worth doing for the sake of itself. But if you don't have some sort of an income, you're never going to be able to develop that in your life. So people who were more well-to-do or had some sort of trust or an allowance of some kind, which, you know, for Americans sounds like you're giving a kid his allowance, but for Europeans in, you know, a country where you had estates and things were passed down to, you know, you'd have an allowance. It was basically, you know, you're getting interest on things and you're getting a certain amount a year, but you don't do any work for it. And there's so many of our artists and writers of the past were living those kind of lives. And it's, you know, that's not really accessible to most people.
Right. Yeah, for sure. So you talked a little bit at the beginning about the two timelines.
Mm-hmm.
And can you tell us more about the protagonists in each timeline?
Absolutely.
And how they're connected?
Yeah. So in the present day is Esther and her mother, Lorena, who suffers from schizophrenia. So Esther lives a very small life because she stays close to home to take care of her mother, to take care of the museum. And she does not even leave the house for very long because she's afraid of what might happen to her mother because of things that have happened in the past. And then Viviana is a sort of a runaway orphan from Catalonia. So she was involved in this sort of struggle between Spain and Catalonia. In the 1800s, there were three different wars called the Carlist Wars. And during the third one, she was involved somehow in the fighting and ended up having to leave the country so that she could avoid prosecution. And so she's kind of hiding out. She has a different identity. She's going by a different name. She's trying to learn French. And she's working in the house of an artist. And that's how she gets involved in this art world. Because as she's working in the house, there's a man named Francisco Vela, who is the ancestor of Esther and Lorena.
Okay.
And he is a merchant from Gibraltar, and he sells pigments and paints. And so they would call him a color man. And he goes on this circuit through different countries in Europe, selling and buying and, you know, around and around he goes. And that's how she meets him and how they get involved.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It's so fascinating. Can you tell me about your research process? Because you told me ahead of time that you did a lot of painting for research, but I'm sure there are other things involved too. But just tell me kind of what that research process looked like for this book.
Yeah. There was a lot of reading. One of the reasons I set the modern timeline partially in my own town, I lived in Lansing for 18 years and East Lansing's just down the road. Part of the reason was so that I didn't have to research that part because there was so much other research. For the information about art itself, you know, you can find in lots of great books. I read a couple books about pigments called The Secret Lives of Color by Cassia St. Clair and Color. What's the subtitle? A Natural History of the Palette by Victoria Finlay. I also read a ton of books about Gibraltar, which I got from my former professor. He has a very extensive library, which is great because a lot of these books you wouldn't be able to find other places.
Right.
Some of them are self-published by people who live there. Some of them are just a little more on the obscure side. And so I read a lot of history, a lot of modern sort of stuff about Gibraltar, but I also did a lot of interviewing of that professor. He grew up in Gibraltar in the 60s and 70s, and so he was a really fantastic source for what it was like then. And at that time, most of his childhood, the border between Gibraltar and Spain was closed. And so if you wanted to leave Gibraltar, you had to go by boat somewhere. And so something that would take, you know, 2 hours now took half a day or more in order to get anywhere. And a lot of people on Gibraltar have relatives in Spain. And so it was really quite a hardship for people. He went to London for his education and then came to the States and has taught here for a really long time. So I got to talk to him a number of times. He lives only maybe an hour and a half away. We got together a couple times over coffee and I just quizzed him the entire time. And when I had questions along the way, I could ask him and he would share it with his WhatsApp group, which is made up of a bunch of people who still live in Gibraltar. Wow. And so they could give me information that you really couldn't find anywhere else.
Right.
Like I had found a particular park that I wanted people to meet at. And then I read that they had moved the monument that was in it. And I'm like, oh, shoot. Now I don't know where that is because on Google Earth, it's here. And so I'm like, I don't know how to figure out if they actually moved it or if they were just talking about moving it. So I asked them and he said, oh, yeah, the attorney general let me know they haven't moved that yet. So I'm like, oh, the attorney general. He probably knows what he's doing.
Wow.
He knows what's going on. Yeah. So yeah, it's really convenient.
Right. There's nothing like real people for those.
Yeah, really. And questions. Then the other piece of it is beyond just sort of painting in general, I painted a self-portrait every month of 2022 when I was doing most of the research and writing for this book. Wow. Because I've never been good at people and I wanted to get better at people. And there's a lot of painting of people, portraits and self-portraits in this book. And the real fascinating thing about women artists is that for so long, they were the only model that was ready to go. So if you had a mirror, you had a model. And so a lot of women artists painted multiple self-portraits.
Right.
As they were practicing.
Wow. That's so interesting. So what can you tell me some of the main themes that are covered in The Lady with the Dark Hair?
Sure. I think the main thing is a sort of discussion or internal conversation about what should women aspire to and what is open to them. In the past timeline, you have all of these restrictions on women's movements. You couldn't go certain places without a chaperone. You couldn't go anywhere in public without a chaperone in France at that time. You couldn't learn the things you wanted to learn. You couldn't do the things that you wanted to do. You had a very small life in a lot of ways. And Viviana, that character, really pushes against that and is looking for ways to make her life different. But in the modern day, I think that women have so much more open to them, but we tend to put restrictions on ourselves. Our own kind of idea of like, well, this is what's expected of me. This is what I have to do. I have to take care of these people. I have to get this done. And so many women that I know say that they want to do something creative or something different. And, oh, I don't have time, or I can't because of this.
Yeah.
I can't learn because of X, Y, or Z. And I'm a hobby collector. I love doing interesting artistic things. Beyond painting, I sew, I've quilted a lot, I garden, I do a lot of home improvement stuff. And you know, you can learn anything on YouTube. Like you can figure it out.
Right.
And I just feel like so many people who tell me they want to do something, I'm like, okay, we'll do it. Like there's nothing stopping you from doing it. But there's this idea of, well, I don't have time because I have to do this. Well, okay, how many kids do you have who are old enough to do some of those things? Like have the other people in your life do some things around the house. It's not all up to you.
Yeah.
And find some time that's just for you. So I think that modern women, well, ideally or maybe theoretically, we say, oh, yes, we can do anything. We restrict ourselves in ways that I don't think we realize.
Right. That's interesting. I want to pivot a little bit from talking about the book to talking about your career and how you started writing. Have you always loved to write? Tell me kind of how you became a published author.
Sure. Well, I was an English major, so, you know, I loved to read. And the interesting thing about being an English major is they teach you how to talk about books, how to write about books, but they never teach you how to create a book. even in creative writing classes, it's, you know, short form, it's poetry and short stories, because you don't have as much time unless you're in an MFA program. There's just not as much time where you can really develop a novel. And then I moved away from where I went to college, and I was just down the road from Michigan State University. And I thought, okay, I'm going to start my graduate degree, because my plan had always been to be a professor. Because what do you do with an English degree? You don't do anything with it. You have to get more degrees.
You can become a podcaster like me.
Exactly. Yeah, right. So I thought, well, this is meant to be. I had put my master's degree on hold because my husband was finishing his, and okay, now we're settled. And I started a master's program, and it really wasn't the program I wanted. It was just the program that was there.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I've worked for a publisher since about a year after I was out of college. So I've worked there for 22 years. Nice. And when you work at a publisher, it makes publishing and books seem more accessible than when you're an English major. Because when you're an English major, you're studying people who are generally dead. And so you can put them on a pedestal and you can assume that they did all of their work in some magical headspace and it was perfect when it came out. And that's not the case.
Right.
And so when you start working with real people who are publishing books now, you realize, oh, these are truly just real people.
Yeah.
And it took a while to translate my good writing, because I was always a good writer. Always got good grades in English class. It took a while to translate that into a good storyteller, because those are two different skills. And so it just takes a while of working on a manuscript that's not working and trying to make it work and then realizing, ah, just throw it away and you start something new. So by the time I think I started writing seriously in 2010 or 2011, but it wasn't until 2019 that my first book was published, and it wasn't the one that I started with.
Sure.
Yeah. So it was a longer road than I thought, because I felt like I was a good writer and I'm working in publishing and I know how to do this.
Yeah.
But it just takes a little while to find your groove and figure out the things that you're doing right and things that you're doing wrong. And ideally with every book you get, it gets a little bit easier maybe, or you get a little more savvy to the problems that you have had in the past and you can avoid some of them. Yeah, so it's really a joy to write these books, and it's been really great to be able to have them published. I'm very grateful for that.
Right. Did you so has Revell published all your books? Did you go the traditional, just find an agent and they found the publisher?
Yeah, I did find an agent. It took a couple manuscripts, and probably, you know, if there's any writers out there who are working at this, it took more than 125 queries to agents for me to find the right person.
Yeah.
So if you're in that situation, the only way to get a yes is to keep submitting and keep trying to learn and get better and don't quit.
Right.
Because it's the person who doesn't quit who eventually reaches their goal. And we shopped around my first book to a number of different, houses, and I actually work for Revell, and I had, my then boss, I was like, I just want you to read this, 'cause you read so many books. I just want to get your opinion on this. And he read it in a couple days, which was really fast because it's a long book, and he was really excited about it and said he would put a sales number on it right now. And I'm like, well, I don't really want to publish with the people I work with. I feel like that has a lot of potential for awkwardness or, I don't know. I just didn't want to do that. And he's like, well, think of us as a backup. And when a couple other things fell through that seemed like they were going to happen, I was like, okay, let's try it. And it's been a really great, relationship. There are definitely times when it's a little dicey, because I am privy to more information than most authors are about their own books. Like, I can just look stuff up.
Yeah.
And I don't want to take advantage of my position as somebody who's like in the company and works with these people, but I also don't want to pretend like I'm not an author and I shouldn't be bothering people about this thing. So it's a fine line. But they've done all six of my books so far. The next one will not be with them because it's just not the right fit for that publisher. So we'll be going back out on submission for that one.
Okay. My next question was, what are you working on next? Can you tell me anything about that?
I can be very vague about it.
Okay.
I can't tell you the subject. My first and sixth book have been dual timeline, historical and contemporary. And in between there has been mostly contemporary.
Okay.
This next one that I'm doing is completely historical. There's no modern timeline. And it's about real people and real events. So that's one of the reasons I'll be looking for a different publisher, because I can't do anything to control these characters because we know too much about them. And they won't have the same sort of arc, that my current publisher kind of needs to have for their audience.
Okay.
I can't make a person more redemptive than they are, you know, in real life if I'm doing historical fiction about a real person. So, I have been the past year, I've done most of my research for that book and I've written a couple of chapters, and probably won't have time to get back to it until I'm thinking probably summer. I have a really full spring promoting this book and doing some things for my book that came out last year that just won an award. And so I need to do some things for that.
Well, congratulations on that.
All good things.
Great. Yeah. So you mentioned it's about real people, but you can't tell me what people.
I can't tell you what people.
That's fine.
And the reason is I'm really surprised no one's told this story yet. And I'm a little afraid to let too many people know what it is, because you know how sometimes there'll be two or three books that come out about the same thing at the same time.
Yes.
Or two movies that come out about the same thing at the same time. And you're like, well, something was in the zeitgeist or something that everybody picked up on. And I don't want to allow anyone else to pick up on this.
Right. Oh, yeah. I understand that. Yeah, I've seen that happen. But I'm excited. I'm looking forward to seeing what it's about when you finally announce it. Okay, so this is a question I ask all my guests. How do you think learning about history through story helps us approach life in the present?
Oh, I think that learning about history through story is the best way to learn history. I'm a firm believer that more people would be interested in history if that's the way we taught it, rather than as a linear series of dates and events. It's so integrated with all the other parts of our lives. And art is integrated with it. The architecture, literature, if you learn it all cohesively at once, you get a picture of these were real people who were not that different from me. And I think it's important to have that view of history, because especially when you are in the black and white version of history before color.
Yeah.
And even the early color, it seems like you're very separated. And I think that it's very true that history is cyclical. The same sorts of things come back around. And if we can learn from history, we can avoid ideally making some of the same mistakes. But if history is so, it feels so distant from us, we feel like, well, we would never make that mistake because I'm not like that person. Well, yeah, you are. We're all like those people. I was doing some reading on the events leading up to World War I years back, mostly because I was dissatisfied with the easy, you know, high school history answer of like, why did it start? I'm sorry. Like, it didn't start because one person got assassinated. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's got to be more going on here. And so I was reading a lot behind that, and it was eerie how similar that time period was to the time period that I was living in the 20 teens. It was freakishly similar. in so many ways. And it was very disturbing, actually, because you know what comes next.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but I think if we did more of that kind of learning of really understanding that there's nothing new under the sun and nobody's coming up with new things at this point, we're all just rehashing the same problems and the same half-baked solutions and things like that.
Yeah.
That I think we might do better in the future if we were more in tune with our history.
Yeah, sure. That is something to strive for. Yeah. Well, Erin, this has been a wonderful conversation. What is the best way for listeners to follow you?
I'm on Instagram at Erin Bartels Writes, and I'm on Facebook at Erin Bartels Author. Those are my two social media platforms. I don't do anything else. And they can also find me at my website, erinbartels.com, and I have a newsletter they can sign up for. And if there are writers out there, I've started a Substack just for writers called Experimental Wolves, and just started that up. It involves a weekly writing prompt, but also a lot of other articles that I'm going to be writing about encouraging writers and learning how to do some heavy revision on your own stuff before you pay for a developmental editor or anything like that. Just something where I can encourage and equip other writers, because I really enjoy doing that.
Yeah. Okay, great. Wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was great. I'm excited about this book, and I'm very grateful that you're helping to spread the word.
Well, friends, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I thought it was great to talk with Erin. Please make sure you go to the show notes where you can find the links to all the things she mentioned there at the end. You can find the show notes either in your podcast listening app or on my website at alisontreat.com/blog. That's alisontreat.com/blog. If you'd like to help out the show, the best way to do that is to follow or subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, which only takes a minute, and also share it with someone you think would enjoy this episode. Now, in light of our conversation toward the beginning about all the terrible quotes about women that started Erin's book, I'm going to share some words from Edgar Degas about Mary Cassatt, who actually features in Erin's book. She is a character for a little bit of the novel. So this is what Edgar Degas said to Mary Cassatt. "Most women paint as though they are trimming hats. Not you. So keep reading historical fiction, my friends, and I will talk to you again next week."